You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
I haven't spoken to my next guest for a few months, and in that few months, he has consolidated his new life in the United Kingdom. Proud South African Garth McKenzie from traderscorner.co.za is on the telephone now. How's it going, Garth? How's the transition from an idyllic life in South Africa, but a life that you were well suited to going to the leafy suburbs of southwest of London, in other words, the county of Surrey, where I was born. How's it going?
Yeah, hi, Lindsay. It's good to catch up with you again after some time.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's going well, thanks. We've been here for 9 months now in the UK. And I must say, we have settled in quite nicely. We've had a relatively soft landing by I think many people's standards, in the sense that we were able to come over here, got our kids into decent schools very easily, bought a house to live in, and was able to make it a home fairly quickly. So, you know, I think on many levels, we've been fortunate that we have managed to have a soft landing over here. And it does help, I think, to make life a little bit easier when you're doing something as tumultuous as moving countries across the world. So yeah, overall we're good. We're enjoying it here, and finding life is generally good, actually.
You've got two children. One is 6 and one is 3. How have they adapted? Because obviously they've had to leave their friends, but on the other hand, children are quite adaptable and they make new friends at new schools. Have they done well? I mean, are they not looking at you and saying, why on earth have you done this, mummy and daddy?
Yeah, they've mostly done well. Look, there have been those times, particularly with my 6-year-old, where he's sort of said, oh, you know, I want to go back to South Africa. I miss my friends and so on. The 3-year-old is too little to really know any different. I mean, he was 2.5 when we moved over here, so he's probably never even going to remember living in South Africa, really. But for our 6-year-old, it's been a difficult adjustment initially. You know, we came over, obviously it's a new environment, new school, new friends, new everything. He's the kid in the class with a different accent. So it's been a difficult adjustment for him, particularly. But he did start to get into his groove quite nicely with everything. And we were, you know, he was playing sport at school twice a week, and he was playing football on a Saturday morning, and doing the Cub Scouts, they call it Beavers over here, on a Monday evening. You know, so we were doing all of those sort of things for him in order to help him make friends and get into a groove in a social circle and whatever. And it was going very well, actually. And then, of course, COVID-19 hit and the lockdown hit. Mm. So, you know, we've all been in lockdown. In fact, we started lockdown a little bit earlier in our household, the reason being that I think I had the coronavirus. I was never tested, but I had all the symptoms in early March, so I'm pretty sure I've had it. And as a result of that, we decided to self-isolate from the 16th of March as a family. And so it's actually since then that we've really been homebound, and our kids haven't been back to school. So we're talking about 10 weeks now where they haven't been back at school. And obviously that is taking its toll on them, and it's taking its toll on the whole family, I suppose. I mean, we all, you know, together in the house constantly. I'm trying to work, my wife's trying to work. The kids get bored. My wife's also been trying to homeschool my son, which is not easy. Certainly take my hat off to school teachers. Gosh, it's not an easy job. So to get back to him, the 6-year-old particularly, you know, he was starting to find his groove and find it a happy medium and get settled into his new life. And then, of course, this whole lockdown hit. So his little world has really been tumultuous in the last year. And I feel for the little guy. But he's you know, he's a high-spirited little chap, and he's doing fine. I'm sure he'll ultimately be fine. But it is sad to see kids having to, you know, experience this. And yeah, he said to me the other day, Dad, can't we go and just, you know, find some other kids to go and kick a ball with on the field? I promise you I'll do social distancing. And I thought, you know, this is a 6-year-old kid talking to me about social distancing. It just, yes. You know, I almost really felt sad thinking that this is how kids have to, you know, he shouldn't even have to know what social distancing is, quite frankly, as a child. But anyhow, that's the world we're in right now, and it is what it is. And I guess we just have to sort of live in hope that this too shall pass and eventually life will return to some semblance of normality again.
Someone will come up with some fancy name for what is going on at the moment and the kids that are born into this. I mean, we've had the baby boomers, we've had the millennials, we still have the millennials, sadly. We've also got Generation X, and it'll go on from there. There will be, because it will go on for another year or so. So there'll be 2 years of societal behaviour that will be characterised by some name. And there will be kids that have either benefited or been disrupted by what's going on. But it's going to be a fascinating social study. And hopefully, you know, if their parent, they're lucky enough to have responsible parents and a decent life. But there will be other kids that won't be so lucky. And it will affect everything. It'll affect markets. It'll affect the way that we invest and everything else, I think.
That's right. And I mean, that's what I keep trying to wrap my head around and think, you know, this is a new world. Because to say life will return to normality, well, it'll be a new normal, I suppose. It's not going to be normal in the way that we knew it before. And then I've been racking my brain to try and think, okay, well, what does that new normal look like? And what are the themes that one can try and play to from an investment standpoint to try and take advantage of that type of new normal? And there's a lot of things emerging, which are interesting. And I think you can see that in the way a lot of stocks have been performing on the stock exchanges around the world. And I'm specifically referring more to the developed world, like the US, where you can see big divergences between, you know, new age companies and old fashioned industrial age type companies that are no longer as relevant as they were. So very interesting to see that playing out at the moment and how it seems to be dictating the type of future that we're likely to see going forward.
Quite right. Final question before we get onto your positioning at the moment and your view of the markets and of the world. Let's have a look at your attitude towards South Africa since you've been in the United Kingdom, which is now around about 9 months. Do you look back at South Africa and say, goodness me, we're really, really small compared to the existence that has unfolded over the last 9 months? In other words, let me give you an example. I'm not explaining myself very well. I came to the Netherlands three and a half years ago, and I thought to myself, well, in South Africa, I could send an email to this person or to that company and say, would you like this, 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 and this? And they say, well, that's very good, but unfortunately, we've already got that. In South Africa, it was relatively easy. If you were well-educated and had the ability to speak properly and converse, in England and Europe in general, no, everybody's doing it. It is so competitive compared to South Africa.
Yeah, that's right. I'm certainly finding that over here. And look, I'm still very much running my South African business remotely. I'm fortunate that it's the type of business that I can do that. So my life from a work and business perspective hasn't really changed at all. But having said that, you know, I am obviously trying to set up something in the UK. I want to get Traders Corner London up and going. And to try and replicate the type of business that I've run in South Africa for the last 10 years, and to try and create something similar over here, focusing on the UK and the US markets particularly. And you're quite right. I mean, you know, in South Africa, I guess this could be anywhere really, but you go, you build a brand, you build up a reputation, you build a network of people that you're familiar with. And I had done that in South Africa. I mean, I'd built a personal brand around Garth McKenzie and Traders Corner, and yes, most of the time, certainly in the financial markets community, people have heard of me and they know who I am. And you can go into a room or a meeting and you go there with some level of credibility just based on your reputation. Whereas over here, it's totally different. Nobody's ever heard of Garth McKenzie or Traders Corner. So it's like starting from the bottom rung of the ladder again. And like you say, things are very competitive. There's 101 other people like me doing what I do, all competing for their slice of the cake over here. And they've all got a head start on me in the terms of the reputation and years of network building and what have you. And I'm, you know, well behind the curve on that front. So it is difficult. And I knew that coming over here, that it wouldn't be an easy thing to just slot into a new network of people from a business standpoint. It's going to take time. I've no doubt about that. But I'm 40 now, so I figure I've still got another 20 or 30 years of work life left in me. And I just have to keep on pushing and keep on putting one foot in front of the other and keep trying to build that reputation in the developed world. But at the same time, as much as I'll do that, I'm certainly not abandoning my South African interests and my South African roots.
You know, no.
I've got a good business there. I've got a very loyal following in South Africa. And as much as I possibly can, I continue to service the clients and the audience that I've got over there, because there is still a good business to be had in South Africa. And it would be daft of me to ignore that.
No, you mustn't ignore it. You mustn't ignore your roots, because eventually cycles tell us that South Africa will be flavour of the month again. And there will be people that, for example, in London, the desks in London saying, well, South Africa now for the next couple of years is where we're going to focus. I mean, for example, the bond market recently, the South African bond market has been a focus of attention from one particular hedge fund. And people are saying, well, look at this yield compared to the yields that we've been used to on other emerging market desks and other developed world bond markets. So there will always be a fashion. And I think if you can establish yourself as a South African specialist living in the United Kingdom, close to London where you are, then that may be your niche. I don't know. But anyway, that's what I've been trying to do from Rotterdam. Let's have a look at the market now, because off air you said to me that you'd been having a look at certain stocks on the JSE Securities Exchange that trade a certain amount. And you came up with a staggering number. I mean, it really hit home to me about the liquidity and the tradability of certain stocks and the untradability of others. Maybe start with the ones that you analysed. In other words, the ones with around about a $1 million per day turnover, which is tiny.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, it was really an exercise I did a little while back, to satisfy my own curiosity, I guess, because now I watch a broad watch list of stocks on the JSE. I have a watch list of about 130 or 140 odd shares that I look at. But you know, it occurred to me that I go through this list every day, and so many of them I just go next, just nothing to see here, you know. And I thought to myself, I need to whittle down this watch list. It's too big. I need to focus on where there is liquidity and tradability. And I thought, okay, well, let me, as a rough guide and a rough rule of thumb, let's say shares that trade more than 20 million rand per day notional value on average, right, every day. Let's try and, you know, filter those ones out. And I came up with a list of 74 shares. And of those 74 shares, then six of them were inward listed. So there's no CFDs available to trade on those shares, which is the game I'm mainly in, CFDs. Yes. So it takes it down to 68 shares. And then I thought, you know, gosh, here I am. I'm a, you know, market strategist, a technical analyst. I'm looking for ideas to try and suggest to clients and try and trade. But, you know, it really occurred to me that the pond that I'm fishing in is barely even counts as a pond anymore. It's more like a puddle now. And that makes it difficult, you know. There are so many stocks that used to be very liquid and very tradable that I watched regularly that simply are no longer even worth trading anymore, just because they've turned into penny shares and the liquidity is no longer there. You know, think about something like an EOH as an example. You know, that was a 150, 180 rand stock at one stage, and it traded plenty. Now it's the 3 rand stock, and it hardly trades much volume. You know, so and there are a number of others like that. So the pool that we play in has become substantially shallower on the JSE, and that is sad, and it's difficult to operate in that sort of environment.
How many stocks can you trade a day efficiently that meet your criteria? In other words, liquidity and interest from overseas and local investors?
Well, look, it depends on your style of trading. So if you are an intraday trader, there are opportunities. There's no question. I mean, you've still got Naspers and Anglo American and Billiton and MTN and Sunlum and quite an array of other stocks that do trade sufficient volume intraday that you can try and capture the small movements on those. The style of trading that I do, however, is not really like, I'm not a day trader. I'm more of a position trader. I'll take positions and hold them for a couple of days to maybe a couple of weeks. And in that respect, you know, I don't come up with opportunities like that every single day. I find that often I can go days without an opportunity where I just have to sit tight and wait. The opportunities do come. You know, every month there's at least five or six or seven you know, opportunities that fit my criteria to trade. So it's fine. The opportunity is sufficiently there, but I'm just saying it's not as clear and easy as it used to be to come up with ideas and opportunities that meet the type of criteria that I look for when coming up with trades.
But you can't do something like have a look at Murray and Roberts Holdings Limited, which has just come out with a business update and trading statement a couple of hours ago. Business update and trading statement, Murray and Roberts Holdings, the share price up 21.3%. That's not the sort of thing that you're looking at because of the liquidity problem. Or again, what are your criteria for investing in a stock? Because you obviously have to get out once you've got in.
Yeah, well, that's it. So, I mean, liquidity obviously is one of the first things I look at. I need to know that I can get in and get out, and also know that getting in and out at a reasonable price. You know, I don't want to have a buy-sell spread that is so wide you can drive a bus through it. Mm. So I need liquidity. That's the first thing. My criteria is very much technical analysis based. So I look for breakouts and I look for tests of support and tests of resistance and that type of thing. And but your technicals work, you know, based on stocks that are fairly liquid, and that, yes, there's enough tradability for those technicals to act out. So something like the example that you've just given of Murray and Roberts, now to me, that's you would have needed to be in beforehand if you had known that was coming, which then you might have been insider trading. But the other way I would possibly then look to trade something like that would actually be to rather try and take advantage of the overreaction, if there is an overreaction, and know that when a share price swings very hard in one direction, it does eventually stall out and you know, move a bit in the opposite direction. So those are the sort of opportunities where I think one can try and look for an overreaction, an overshoot to some news like that, where you perhaps didn't expect the news to come. But once it came, then the opportunity presents itself in the form of the overreaction.
Okay, maybe there's been an overreaction to the upside in certain markets. I mean, even the South African market consolidating itself for a while anyway above 50,000. I think it was 52,000 at one stage, which on Friday dipped below 50,000. I don't know where it is now, but let that not detain us. I look at something like this headline: AngloGold Ashanti shut South African mine after finding 164 coronavirus cases. That tells me that maybe the worst is to come for South Africa, and although we're opening up, maybe we'll have to ease back the opening up or even close down again afterwards. And does that affect your thought process? And does that make you look at different sectors of the market and say, well, this one will do well, like Distell, for example, has done well today, up 6%, and the miners will do badly because they'll have to shut down their operations? So many different moving parts.
There are lots of different moving parts. And I mean, even within the miners, you've then got to take it one step further and say, you know, some mines are more susceptible than others. So a lot of the broker research that I've seen recently has said that if you're going to be focusing on the mining space, you want to focus on the open pit miners, where you've got, you know, these gigantic articulated dump trucks that are driven by one person and can carry, you know, 200 tons of ore or whatever in the back. Rather, that type of operation is not likely to be so susceptible to the coronavirus, as opposed to these deep level mining stocks where you've got to jam 50 guys in a lift and send them, you know, a kilometer underground to go and find what they're looking for. So you do have to be careful and look selective in that respect. That's just the talking about the mining space now, but obviously you're right, there are other sectors of the market, some that are going to be more affected than others. You know, we've noticed, for example, the banking sector of the market is very weak by and large. And I guess that is a function of the weak economy. Bad debts are likely to tick higher, even though interest rates have come down. So banking shares have remained pretty much under pressure, and likely to remain so probably. Distell being up as it is, most likely on the back of the fact that now alcohol sales will be allowed. So yeah, that makes sense why the stock is up as much as it has been. Yeah, so you most definitely do need to look at specifics and think what various developments regarding the coronavirus and the lockdown and the easing of the lockdown might do for various companies. Yeah.
Okay, so where are you positioned at the moment, if at all?
At the moment, I'm not positioned in anything right now. Actually, it's a public holiday in the US and the UK, so I'm not actually into anything right now. However, I am watching MTN. I think MTN at around about 50 Rand. There's quite nice solid support around that area. So I'll be looking at possibly buying that into any more weakness now. And then offshore, I follow the S&P 500 quite closely. And there, for years when we've been talking, I think I've often said to you, I put these option structures on. And I'm running an option structure up to July there, where it's a put spread option structure. So it'll make money if the S&P 500 closes out below 3,000 in July, and then I'll make some money. If it's above 3,000, then I'll lose my premium, and it's not the end of the world.
Be careful. It's 29.83 at the moment on the futures market, up 1%, obviously in very thin conditions because of no London and no real market later on. But it's pushing up there. It's up a percent today, and I can't understand the rationale, given that I think 12 states of the United States that have opened up have announced a spike in coronavirus or COVID-19 infections over the last 24 hours. I don't understand why the S&P is up here.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of confusion around the way the market has just rallied so aggressively off the lows, when in fact, at an economic level, things are still not good. And the market almost looks like it's pricing in a V-shaped recovery. But economically, it's very difficult to believe that there's going to be a V-shaped recovery. I think when it comes to the US markets, the one thing that really has been a big driver is the fact that the Federal Reserve has just continued to pump stimulus into the economy and into the market at an unprecedented rate. Mm. And a lot of that money seems to be finding its way into stocks, and that's been driving up the S&P 500. Also, something to keep in mind when we talk about S&P 500 is that it's become quite a skewed market, in the sense that it's become very, very heavily weighted towards a handful of stocks. There's about five or six shares that really make up the bulk of the weighting of the S&P 500 now, and it's all your Microsoft, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, these tech kind of companies that have been, and Google is another one, that have been very, very strong over the years, and they've started to make up a disproportionately large weighting of the S&P 500. So, you have to dig a little bit below the surface and say, well, those shares are doing very, very well. But those shares are also being offset by weaker performances in a number of the other old economy stocks in the US as well. So, for example, like your banking sector in the US also still under pressure. And something like, for example, General Electric, which is, once an almighty great industrial company. I mean, that stock has just been an absolute disaster and continues to plunge into new low territory. So you've got this huge discrepancy between sectors of the US market that are doing well and sectors that are not doing well. But do just keep in mind that it does appear that there are sort of a fairly small handful of very mega cap stocks that are strong and are sort of, I suppose, creates a little bit of an illusion that the S&P 500 is doing, or that the US stock market broadly is doing better than what it actually is. When you scratch below the surface, not all the stocks are doing so well.
We've had a massive bounce back from the horrible lows of the end of March of 2020. It's not so much a blanket selling environment or a blanket buying environment anymore. End of February, beginning of March, you could have sold anything and anything would have gone down. Apart from those FANG stocks that you've just been talking about, it would have been an easy trade. It would have been like treading on ants. What is it now? Is it a stock picker's market, an asset class picker's market? What is it?
Yeah, it does certainly seem to be a stock picker's market. And you've got to look, I mean, where the strength is now seems to very much be in those new age types of companies. So look at things like, for example, Netflix is a great example of a new age company that's been very defensive during this time. And that stock's still at new highs, notwithstanding everything that's going on in the world. And it makes sense. People have been locked down in entertainment and streaming movies and things. There's a big, big business now. So that's the kind of stock that's done well. Other things that are doing well are something like Peloton. So for those who don't know Peloton, it's a company that, it's quite simple, really, but they make an exercise bike that's effectively got an iPad on the front of it. And you have the ability to do your spinning class in the comfort of your own home while you've got some pretty girl on the other side of the iPad who's actually there. She's real. She's doing the class with you at the same time. But
but
you know, you can log in and do these classes remotely from the comfort of your own home.
And so people like that stuff, don't they? I mean, there's certain types of people that like that sort of. Well, I just did a class with this girl in a leotard who was in, you know, Silicon Valley or something like that.
No, that's right. And then it also links into the whole social media realm as well, where you can now share your workout with, you know, millions of other people that are also doing the same workout at the same time.
Would you like to share your workout with millions of people?
Well, look, I think I certainly wouldn't stand out, let's put it that way.
Okay, Garth, quickly, your advice to someone who is considering, has the means, first of all, and with those means, is considering moving away from South Africa. What would your advice be to them?
Well, I think, first of all, do your homework and make sure you know what you are getting yourself into. We're very fortunate. We did do a lot of research. My wife and I came over here for 2 weeks, and we kicked the tires very thoroughly. And friends of mine joked, they said, are you going there with your tourist eyes on? And I said, no, I'm going there with my calculator. And I literally did. I mean, I came over, we researched the cost of living, the cost of everything, areas to live in, schools, all sorts of things. We tried as best as possible to ensure that we knew what we were getting ourselves into, and that when we arrived here, we wouldn't face any unexpected surprises. And I must say that, you know, having done that research really, really did help us tremendously, in the sense that we were able to come in, land here, and set up a life quite quickly and quite easily. And we weren't to be honest, there's been very little that has surprised us, in the sense of nothing big has surprised us, let's put it that way.
Did the UK authorities make it easy for you?
Well, they did. They did make it all easy for us. Look, we also had the unique situation that my wife has a British passport and my two sons have British passports.
There we go.
And I could qualify for an ancestral visa in my own right. So that obviously was a huge benefit for us, which not everybody has that benefit. But that definitely helped us. And I know from other friends of mine let's not beat around the bush. There's a massive wave of immigration out of South Africa and skills exiting South Africa at the moment. I've got 12 friends in my fairly close circle that have left South Africa in the last year and a half. And some of them are here in the UK, some have gone to New Zealand, and some have gone to Australia. And for some of those people, it's been easier to get into those countries than it has for others, due to passports or skills or money or whatever the case might be. But I think, to answer your original question, you know, make sure you do your research, and because honestly, doing your research and knowing what you're getting yourself into allows you to then plan properly. And by planning properly, you can avoid making a lot of costly mistakes when it comes to a huge life-changing thing like this.
I promise you, this is my last question, but you've got 12 friends in your immediate circle that have already left, whether it be to the United Kingdom, to the Antipodes, or wherever it is. I mean, that's the denudation of the tax base, which is actually very frightening. I mean, it's not as if I don't know about it, but when you say it, I suddenly think, hello, what's going on here?
Well, it is very frightening, Lindsay. And the thing is that these are all families that were probably earning, you know, one and a half million rand a year plus.
Yes.
They were in the top tax bracket. And they were skilled. I mean, we're talking engineers, scientists, doctors, IT professionals, etc. And those are the ones that have left, right? And I mean, I could probably list another 20 that I know who are right now in the process of looking to leave and are making seriously making plan B to move somewhere else. So since we've been here in the UK, not obviously in the last 2 or 3 months with the lockdown, but before that, we have hosted, I don't know how many friends and family that have come over here on a look-see trip to the UK, because they're also thinking of making the move. It is actually quite frightening. And like you say, it's a huge degradation of the tax base and the skills base in South Africa. And it's very, very sad. Yeah. And I don't, obviously I've voted with my feet already. So take it from where it comes. But I mean, I'm patriotic to South Africa. I love South Africa. I would have loved to stay there.
As do
I. But I just didn't like the way things were going there. And I worry for the future of my kids. And we ultimately, we looked at the situation and said, you know, this is just not sustainable. We need to make a plan to set up life somewhere else.
And you've done so, and you've assimilated yourself very well, and hopefully that your aspirations to expand Traders Corner will go to the City of London and beyond, I hope. Garth, thanks so much for your time. That's Garth McKenzie from traderscorner.co.za. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.